Welcome, everyone, to the latest installment of the MP Access podcast. My name is David Wharton. I'm the editor-in-chief of Mortgage Point and the Five Star Institute. We're joining us today. We have a gentleman from the Brookings Institute. We are speaking to Joe Jerko of the Martin Buxbaum. He's the Martin Buxbaum Professor of Real Estate, Finance, and Business and Public Policy at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, and also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He recently penned an article entitled "The Ripple Effects of Banning Institutional Purchases on Single-Family Rentals," which has been a topic that we've seen a lot in the news over the last couple of months for the Brookings Institution. And we're going to use that as a launching off point for our conversation today. So welcome to the show, Joe.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So I know this has been a topic that the president mentioned earlier in the year, and we've seen a lot of people kind of discussing, you know, Congress is discussing it. And I know they've been working focused on topics like how do you define a large investor? You know, where's that dividing line? But looking kind of at the broader scope of this, you know, there is this public narrative that larger investors, as opposed to the more smaller mom and pop folks, are helping drive this housing unaffordability crisis. From your perspective, is there accuracy to that, or is that a misnomer? What do you think?
It's a misnomer. They're not. They're just the institutional investors are not unimportant, but they're just a very small share, a fraction of the single family rental market, in particular, and definitely of the overall stock of housing. It's pretty tiny.
Do you have like a percentage of that, or do you have any of those numbers that you can?
My research, but others have done it. So I'll give you some basic data on the housing market first. And most of your listeners won't care, but it's useful to know.
It might surprise you. We got a lot of data folks on this.
So total occupied housing units in the United States are about 133 million. There are a lot of us, and occupied housing units are occupied by households. Now, a household, I have two kids who are single and unmarried. They're 29 and 27. They're their own individual households because they no longer live with mom and dad. My wife and I are a household. 133 million of us out there, of which 46 million plus, about 35%, are renter owner occupied units. The other 65% are owner occupied. Now, the question here is, before we get to institutional, how many of those rental units that are occupied are single family units in nature? And the answer is about a third, a little over 14 million. Are single family rental units. The vast majority single family detached, some just standalone townhomes,
yeah,
and the like. Okay. Now, then the question is, so that's it. We have 14 million such units. How many of them are owned by institutions? As you noted in your introduction, there is no legal definition of what an institution is. But
right.
There are researchers, again, not my work, but others, and I'll cite one from the Hamilton Project at Brookings by Ellen and Goodman, and they estimate that institutional investors own just about 3% of the rental stock. So 3% of that, 14 million, of that. Now that just tells you it's a small number. Already, it's 3% of the rental stock, which was 35% of the total housing stock. So you're getting basically 1% of the total housing stock nationally. So it's just not big. And by the way, I gave you the highest estimate I can find in the literature. They're really good data providers to the real estate industry who think the institutional share is smaller. Now, it does depend on how you define institutions. The most common is it's an entity that owns more than 100 single family units and rents them out. Some use 1,000, but that's it. So even if you enacted a policy, and this is not Mr. Trump's proposal, even if you enacted a policy that said single family institutions cannot own single family rental, they would have to disgorge. it would only increase the number of those units would go from the rental sector to the owner-occupied sector as the private equity firms sold the units. It would increase the owned stock by 1% or so, certainly
Yeah.
not more than two. That's my point. It's not that big a deal. In general, it's not a major part of the stock institutionally owned. Is just not that big.
Why do you think there is this perception of this institutional ownership being a bigger deal? Is it just they're kind of throwing everything at the wall? Is it just that people see corporation as opposed to, oh, that's Joe who owns three houses in this?
So that the honest answer is, I don't know. I suspect it's a combination of the factors you mentioned, which is not all of us have sympathy for small mom and pops, right? We just identify better, less so for Blackstone, KKR, and the like, the big private equity firms. So I think part of it's just that. And part of it is we don't look at the data all that carefully. That's why I bored your listeners with some of those numbers just to go, it's roughly their institutional ownership is 1%, maybe a little more, of the 133 million housing units in the United States. Just not that big.
Do you know, has that number or that percentage changed materially over the years? Like at the rent.
It went up from about zero prior to the global financial crisis. So institutional owners, there have always been mom and pops owning large numbers of single family units that they rented out. So think about just individual families. It was a retirement plan, which is we'll buy a couple, rent them, and that'll finance our senior aging and the like. That's been around forever. Institutions didn't understand they could make money in this market until the global financial crisis, and Blackstone was the market leader in this. They went around and started buying up defaulted mortgages and took over the homes. And then they used modern technology to go, we can actually operate these with technology and we can make a decent profit compared to, say, standard apartments, which they've all, private equity and publicly traded firms have always owned big apartment buildings. But they figured out a way to make money owning portfolios of individual single family detached properties. That came about only after the global financial crisis. So it's a pretty new niche in general. In general.
Well, I know one of the things that you mentioned in your research that you shared was if any of these policies were put into place, institutional investors, these changes might, or excuse me, having these institutional investors purchasing these homes, they might slightly increase home prices in some areas, but also slightly reduce rents. Is that, could you unpack that just a little bit? What factors are happening there?
Again, not it's not been studied by me directly, but by other
Sure.
economists. There are individual metropolitan areas, and you're in Texas, so you're in some of those. There are areas where institutional ownership is anywhere from 25 to 40% of single family rental. So they have big concentrations. And I'll just name off a couple: Atlanta, Charlotte, Dallas, Houston, Las Vegas, Miami, Florida, Nashville, Tennessee, Orlando, Phoenix, and the like. So there are markets where their concentration is far, far higher. Why is the average across the nation 1+%? Because in those cities I listed, I did not list one large West Coast market or any East Coast markets, right? So this institutional ownership doesn't appear to work in those. And you got to be in growth areas so they can raise rents. I mean, these are for-profit companies that are doing this. So there are markets. So what happens in a suburb? It's usually the researchers who look at this study zip codes. So they're looking at neighborhoods or two to three neighborhoods within a zip code. And what they find is the following, which is, okay, if institutions come in and buy up single family units, and withdraw them from the owner-occupied stock and rent them out, right? There's no net change in housing. No new housing is being created. It's just being moved from owned to rental. Okay. What that does is it boosts home prices a little bit because we reduce the stock of it. Okay. But it also turns out the research shows it actually causes rents to be lower in those neighborhoods because they've increased the rental stock in general. So you get this combination of things. This is why I think it's always, I tell my students, at least at Wharton, it's a dangerous thing to just, study home ownership separate from rental and vice versa. And this is a particularly good example because what's happening is when an institution buys a single family home, they remove it from the stock of owner occupied and put it, it's a zero. In economics, it's called zero sum. It's a one for one trade across the sectors. And basic economics show you that that's what's going to happen. If I lower the owned stock, prices will go up by a bit. How much? 1 to 3 percentage points. It's not 10, it's not 20, it's not 25. And why do rents go down by? Pretty much the same, a little bit more. They go down by, but so renters benefit, homeowners are harmed to some extent. The ones who would have done that, by the way, the existing owners, I own my house. If this happens in my neighborhood, I'm a beneficiary of the through capital gains on my house, not of a lot, but something. It's, my house is worth a decent amount of money and added 1 to 2%, that's not nothing. For me, that's my point is you're trading off owned and rental, and I personally don't view owners as superior to renters. My wife and I own our 27 and 29-year-old rent, and there's nothing wrong with them renting, so I see no reason to rate them as inferior to, mom and dad.
Well, between what you're discussing of it being kind of localized depending on the market and just the part of the country, and that combined with just the overall, as you pointed out, this being ultimately kind of a small percentage of the market in general, do you think that more targeted policies are really what should be rolled out if you're trying to address this in certain places rather than trying to solve this on a nationwide level, or do you think there's even reason for that?
I think there are good policies that could be pursued. This is not one of them, in my opinion. And the good policies are those that increase the overall stock of housing. The biggest affordability problems are in home ownership rather than rental, because we tend to build more rental units. Rental vacancy rates go above 10% in downturns and they fall. They've gone up a percentage point nationwide. So that just says we're building more rental units than we are owner occupied. What we need to do is increase the supply of housing. That's how we ultimately get out of this. I mean, moving a given unit from owner occupied to rental or rental to owner occupied does not increase the total stock of housing. If we just label it an owned unit versus a rental unit, it's still the same. We have to increase building. And that's a hard thing to do in our system. It's a system of local control. And the reason, and there are good reasons for that, right? I mean, the reason, one, permitting and the allowance or denial of project proposals is a state function in almost all states. Delegate it to localities. And the thinking behind that is that the locals know way more. I live in Pennsylvania. I live in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, suburb of the city of Philadelphia. And we know way more about the costs and benefits of a development proposal in Swarthmore than the governor does in Harrisburg. That's our capital, and way more than the folks running the federal government in DC do. That's the thinking, and there's real truth to that. The problem is we're prone to turn down these project proposals. Why? All new development has costs, right? It could be minor temporary costs, like you're going to run a dump truck at 7 a.m. across from me in a project. We don't, the locals who control the process don't have to consider the lost utility or benefits that outsiders would have received had the project been approved, the units been built, and they got to move into my locality, which has a really good school district. That's why my wife and I moved in. So we're very sensitive to costs, but we don't have to count all the benefits, particularly the foregone benefits when projects are turned down. So we just don't approve much. And we certainly don't enough. And the news there is it used to be this was a problem only in the big coastal markets. On the East Coast, think Boston, New York, and Washington. On the West Coast, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego. It has spread to your part of the country now. It's in the Sun Belt where price rises have been very sharp, and very sharp, not just as a COVID phenomena, but they've been higher than average, than the average in the country since the turn of the century. So it's the Sun Belt markets which are figuring out how to restrict development. And that's a recipe for affordability problems because guess what? A lot of people still want to move into your markets. There's good jobs, good weather, less high taxes and the like. But you guys are ratcheting down the rate of new supply. You still build way more than Boston, New York, et cetera, but you don't build as much as you did in the past. That's the problem.
And I'm sure there's not an easy answer to this because we've been talking about this at least as long as I've been doing this, and I've heard a lot of people throw ideas out. But from your perspective, are there policy proposals or solutions to these issues of, frankly, we just need to be building more that you think are realistic, you think have a chance of actually happening in the near future, or are we just kind of in this quagmire where we are now?
Yeah, I have a couple that I like. None of them will solve the affordability problem in general. So we're going to have to work at the. It took us decades to get in this mess. It's going to take us years to get out. But some. My friends at the American Enterprise Institute, which is down the street from Brookings in DC, have cataloged all the federal land owned across the country and in the western part of the United States. Turns out the federal government owns a lot. Now, a lot of that land is nowhere near a labor market, right? Our Air Forces use it as bombing ranges, and that's how they practice. But Las Vegas has become a fairly expensive Sun Belt market in the last 20 years. The feds own a lot of land on the metropolitan fringe of Las Vegas. One policy the folks at AEI have proposed, which I think is absolutely on target, is sell the federal land near the urban area where people would live and could commute to jobs with the stipulation that you've got to build housing on it. You can't hold it vacant. You can't. So I like that idea. I like there is a bill that has passed the Senate Banking Committee, but not anything else. It's the Road to Housing Act of 2025 or something like that. It proposes to use the federal government's grants, its programs and grants and the like, to give more grants to communities that build more housing. I like that idea a lot. And then there are others that'll be way more pie in the sky that only an academic like me could do, which we're going to have to reform our basic zoning codes and make them more generic and allow more building by right so that it's not this torturous, costly, long quasi-judicial review process that developers hate when they have to do projects and the like. But that one will take much longer time to do. But yeah, there are short run things that could help us build more. And that's where I think I would focus all my energy, not on something that doesn't increase the net supply of housing.
Yeah, you kind of touched on this, and you mentioned the AEI. We just spoke with Ed Pinto from that a couple of days ago, and one of the proposals that he went into was down to zoning reform, which I know is a big focus from them. Do you think that that's a meaningful solution as far as simply changing the amount or the amount of what you can put on this land? You know, whether you could put a duplex or a triplex or something beyond just a single family lot on a bunch of land, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, I think we should be much more flexible. If I'm sure Ed talked about, upzoning, which is just a synonym for densification, We should try to upzone everything we can in general. And the question is, it's a political question. So, from an economics point of view, Ed and I would agree on almost all the policies, I suspect. But there's a politics to it. And there's, in my neighborhood, we like it is. So, if you want to build a project near us, you're probably going to get turned down because we're going to argue the costs are too high. And we vote in the local election, so we can fire the mayor if we don't like the decision. And all the outsiders who would benefit from moving into the new housing, they don't live in the jurisdiction, so they don't get the vote at all. What's the mayor going to do? The mayor's going to appoint a zoning board that's going to listen to the neighbors. We need to change that structure somehow. But that's a longer political process. That this structure exists for a reason, and the locals like it. It's going to take a lot of education to go. The way I think about it and try to convince people is my wife and I have done very well. We happen to own two houses. We have a vacay a lake house in the northern part of Pennsylvania, but our kids can't afford to own. And we need to change the rules of the game so that they can afford. We, as I try to, you don't want to be the last generation which had good access to home ownership and your kids don't. But that's a political question. That's not an economic question. So I can spout all the economics I want, but at the end of the day, it's a political decision to approve or not approve enough housing. I can just tell you as an economist, we're not approving enough right now, for sure. And it's not just in the big coastal markets, which have been expensive, for 40 years now. It's in your part of the country. That's what's new.
Well, you mentioned it took us decades to get into this mess, and so now we got to work our way out of that. So, just looking ahead broadly over the next 5, 10 years, what do you think? Are there trends that you see likely playing out on this front, whether it's affordability or inventory? What are you expecting to see over that span, if you have any thoughts?
I think the after effects of COVID and the Fed raising of rates will dissipate. They made a bad problem worse. Okay, so there are a couple of recent events, which, for instance, the Fed's increasing of rates beginning in March 2022 until quite recently, where they've started to ratchet down. That was the biggest increase in rates, I think, forever. I'm not a macro economist, but it was big. And basically, if you have a 3% mortgage, you don't want to move because if you move, you have to take out a 6 or 7% mortgage, and you may not be. That has lowered the amount of listings of existing homes available for sale. That's made the affordability problem worse. That will dissipate over time. Okay. The COVID supply chain snafus, we couldn't complete housing for a while, right? That's gone. So I think the piling on effects of COVID and Fed policy will dissipate and we'll get a bit of a break from that. I do think we can upzone, we can sell federal land, we can encourage localities. Hey, think about your kids, not just you. So yeah, I think we can make progress on this, but I'm not at all optimistic. It just takes too long to build. So we're not getting out of this next year or the year after. It's going to take a while, but my recommendation and my hope is that the YIMBY movement that you see of young people going, yes, in my backyard, as opposed to no, in my backyard, that's a real force. And again, that's people in my children's demographic. And because they're feeling the stress, they can't afford to own. So I hope to see some political coalition coming together that will support pro-development policies.
Well, one topic that I know I've heard economists and some of the other people we've spoken to theorize about is this so-called silver tsunami as the boomers aging up. In theory, they would have downsized, they would have moved to retirement communities or whatever, and then those homes would be go on the market or go to their kids or whatever. And that seems to be offset some by kind of what you're talking about like now their rates are so low, like why mess with it? I've got this house, even if I've got more space than I need. Do you see any of that changing currently or on the horizon or?
Long run. I mean, the other issue there is one that I'm delighted with is us old folks live longer. So
Sure.
we're going to stay in our houses longer because we're healthier.
Yeah.
It's just not my dad's generation where everyone was a hard manual laborer. And at age 65, you were worn out. It's just not so
Yeah.
anymore. So, no, I don't think we're going to get a break. Look, in the long run, if population growth stays really low, the bad news is I may be healthy now, but I'm pretty sure I'm not going to live forever. Ultimately, my house will become vacant. But that's too long in the future. I'm going to turn 70 this year. Let's hope I make 10 to 20 more years. It's too long to wait for that. We have to enact some good policies before then.
Right. Well, Joe, I thank you for your time today. You've given us some great insights on things, and I really appreciate you setting aside some time to speak with us here at the MP Access Podcast.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Well, thank you everybody for tuning in. We've been speaking with Joe Jerko of the Brookings Institution and speaking on the topic of the single family rental investor ban and how that may impact or may not impact the larger housing market. We'll see you next time on the next episode. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. Thanks for listening to MP Access. Stay up to date with daily mortgage news, featured stories, and our latest episodes of the podcast at themortgagepoint.com. Don't miss out, and we'll see you next week.